As I look back at 50 years of this participation in a wonderful trio and music that has really guided me, informed me ethically, and been a surrogate parent of sorts, I look at this evolution of my musical life, and I recognize that I'm aware of a higher politic now than just the left or just the right. Liberal, progressive, these are expressions of the heart. And so the path that I've been on since, I would say, probably the early 70s, which is to try to discover how I can best make this a better world without creating enemies at the same time. You know, so many instances of history have shown that people that draw lines in the sand to make a better world don't really make a better world. They just divide their part of what they think is a better world from the other better world. And this overarching sense that we are truly spirits looking for communion and community together really has resulted in just about every piece of music that I create, albeit not, you know, religious music particularly.
Yeah.
But nonetheless touches on that spiritual nature that we all share. And at the same time, I'm aware of this spiritual evolution. I'm also a touchstone to Pete Seeger, and I'm also, you know, very aware of the legacy that I've inherited and grown up with from Woody Guthrie and from Josh White. And so there's a practical or a political expression of this, and it comes together in a song on my new album that everybody knows called America the Beautiful, where I audaciously, as far as my wife is concerned, created two new verses to better reflect the sense that I think our citizenry wants expressed in terms of its appreciation and love for America.
Oh, bountiful of forest green, of lake and fertile lands, where seeds of hope are tended by thy sons and daughters' hands. America, America, the earth still calls to thee, where human life and nature strive to live in harmony.
By being able to think about the spiritual aspect and the political aspect of issues, that is the ultimate expression of my appreciation for the generation that grew and became aware in the 60s, was that they added all this to our vocabulary and they made it okay to talk about these things.
Mm-hmm.
So
I couldn't agree with you more. Where it surfaces in conversations for me is people lamenting the end of folk music, and mm-hmm. I look at them, you know, not from the standpoint of Louis Armstrong, who used to say everything was folk music. You never heard a horse sing, did you? I look at them and say, I don't think you recognize the fact that folk music's major impact was contextual, that what it did was release the capacity of pop music to speak to so many issues that we hold in common. So we certainly didn't prior to the 50s. I mean, it was all love songs, and if something came along that wasn't, it was considered a novelty tune. But ever since the 60s, the March on Washington, Dylan's writings, and the impact then on all of pop music, and even country and western music. When I say even country and western music, it used to be thought of as the poor, uneducated cousin of pop music.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called hillbilly music at one point or another, but all of the folk writers and a lot of the deeper thinkers went to Nashville and wrote continue to write story songs that are very compelling and very revealing about the human experience.
You know, but in light of all this high-minded talk, I have to tell you, Noel, that the one song from your catalog that I really wanted to ask you about specifically today, I dig rock and roll music.
Yeah. Songs come from a lot of different sources. Some of them are really, the concept is sitting there waiting to be said, and you find a musical format that suits it. But I Dig Rock and Roll Music was a musical format that was looking for a lyric that, in a sense, underlined its joy, because I think it's a very happy melody. And the fact that we knew the people that we sang about and, in a sense, could tweak their nose stylistically by duplicating it was, you know, it was not only a punch in the arm, you know, kind of a friendly, the way the guys do when they're in the locker room or something.
Yeah.
But it was also, part of it was, see, we could do this too if we wanted to. That's mostly, I think, behind it. And we had so much fun. Peter playing guitar backwards tape, behind the Beatles verse, and me doing the put on of Donovan's voice, and Mary and Peter doing the Mamas and the Papas wailing. Yeah, it was a gas. It's no wonder that you enjoy it. I think people, you know, the first time that I heard that song performed by somebody else, it was by the band at Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey for the Elephants. You can imagine, oompa, 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 oompa.
I dig rock and roll music and I love to get the chance to play
and sing it.
I figure it's about the happiest sound going down today. The message made
that must be an odd experience when you're out there in the world and you hear one of your songs coming back to you like that.
Well, it's usually not so much fun.
Really? Yeah.
That was a particularly fun experience.
Mary passed away in 2009 after a bout with leukemia. And I wonder how, if you and Peter and Mary had discussions about how the group might continue after her passing.
You mean the way that older folks would talk about the way they wanted a funeral service designed, or what would happen if one of the couple passed away, and would they go into an assisted living? No, we never had that conversation. I think we, and I don't think it was a case of denial. I think it was probably the illusion that notoriety gives you, that you're riding a wave of awareness that will continue even after you have passed away. And so there really seems so little need to talk about what will happen, since so much of what you've produced is going to live long after you.
What are some ways that you feel her spirit with you now when you perform with Peter?
Well, curiously, that's exactly when it happens. If I'm doing solo concerts, I will certainly speak to Mary's absence and to the great legacy that I feel I've inherited from the two of them in the trio. But the sense of Mary's presence is a remarkable thing that does happen when Peter and I do a concert. Whether that's manifested just in the references that Peter and I will make individually to a moment that we might have shared historically. And, you know, I think most people who've been to a Peter, Paul, and Mary concert in the past know that nothing is scripted. I mean, we have rather large, sketchy outlines, but everything is real and of the moment. So when we make these references, you know, we're really trying to call back a memory of or touch upon something that moved us at the time about Mary. But when we start doing the songs, Mark, particularly a song like Jet Plane, and we turn to the audience and we tell them that they're going to be singing Mary's part and we'll do the harmony, then something very wonderful happens. We all are in two places at once. We exist 5 years ago at a Peter, Paul, and Mary concert, watching the trio sing, because isn't that Mary's voice we're hearing? And then we're now, some 5 years later in 2013, sitting in an auditorium with 2,500 other people, being the Spirit of Mary. It's a delightful moment, not one that happens at very many concerts of other groups, I think, where a central figure has passed away. Because in a sense, I think the desire there is to keep the element of death away and not to understand that it's part of, a larger picture. And so there is a kind of a naturalness and acceptance, in a sense, a celebration of, and it's very nostalgic, but it's not dour at all. It's, it has a special value that everyone seems to recognize, and we get it out of the way right away when Peter and I step out on stage and start talking simultaneously after the first song. I mean, and we don't stop. People think it's a mistake because Peter's speaking and I'm speaking and we're both talking and the audience is befuddled trying to figure out who to pay attention to. And finally what begins to surface is, now that Mary is no longer with us, nobody's exercising any control over our stage presence anymore. It's every man for himself. And there's a lightness, I think, even conveyed in that chaos.
That sounds like a very Ernie Kovacs kind of moment also. Can you give us an example of the kind of musical shorthand that you and Peter must have evolved over all this time?
You mean how high can our eyebrows go?
If that's the case. I just wonder, an example of the language that you two have grown for yourselves.
You know, we try to have as much eye contact as possible because that's a real clue as to how the next verse is going to be handled or where the tempo is going to move to, if it's going to move. But then again, so much of it is of the moment that if one of us totally missed the signal, it just becomes a delightful way of catching up. The shorthand really, I think, starts with the letter T and stands for trust, because it isn't that we can anticipate so well, it's that we have no invested ego in wherever it should go. We just delight in each other's directions. It's interesting you should ask that because we are just completing a book that's due out. Well, it's been due out for about a year, but I think it's finally going to make it next spring, called Peter, Paul, and Mary, 50 Years Together in Life and Music. And in the process of doing that, you're rediscovering all of these things that we've appreciated for those 50 years about each other. Some of it from Mary's personal writings, and they're all ending up in this book. Peter and I are doing the text for the book. We're not assigning it to anybody else. We're trying to make it as personal as possible. So some of these questions that you've asked are very pertinent to what we're rediscovering about who we've been these past 50 years.